Advisory Board. And then we have Jeannie Biddle, who is the Director of Technology for the Scott County Schools in Kentucky, and who is also a member of the ISTE Board, among other things. So you can read more about the panelists in your packet, so I'm not going to take up any more of our time today. My name is Amanda Lenhart, and I'm a Senior Research Specialist with the Pew Internet and American Life Project. And I'm actually going to kick off the panel today with a short presentation that sort of is going to contextualize what we're talking about with some of the data that I've collected and some of the data that some of my colleagues at the University of New Hampshire have collected. And then each of the other panelists is going to talk very briefly from their own experience, and then we're going to open it up for your questions. So be thinking about your questions, and there are microphones on either side of the room, and I hope once we sort of wind down, you can line up in front of those microphones with hundreds of fabulous questions that we will barely have time to answer. So so start thinking, and again, thanks very much. So I also have a lot of material like Anastasia and not very much time to cover it, so I'm going to move through it relatively quickly. And so just so that you, those of you who don't know, the Pew Internet and American Life Project is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research center based in Washington, D.C., and we study the social impact of the internet on Americans. And in particular, I focus on teenagers. The work that I'm going to present today, that's my data, comes from a series of interviews of 700 parent-child pairs that we did in November, and then 935 parent-child pairs we interviewed the previous November. All of the work that I present is teens ages 12 to 17, and generally an interview with a parent or guardian as well. Our samples are nationally representative, and also some of this is based on focus group research that we've been doing over the past years. I'm also going to, again, intersperse some data from the Crimes Against Children Research Center based at the University of New Hampshire. David Finkelhor and Janice Wolak are the two main researchers there. And a partner of theirs, Michelle Ibarra, who has her own research center called the Internet Solutions for Kids, has also done some research that I'll talk about today. So just to contextualize very broadly, like, what are we talking about when we talk about the internet and internet use today, and what's happening? So 94% of teens 12 to 17 are going online. Most of them are going online from home. 77% of teens say that they do go online from school, but that's actually a relatively significant portion who say that they actually don't go online from school. 71% are going online from a relative's house or a friend's house. 60% now go online from libraries. Households, 66% of households now have broadband access. 22% are still on dial-up, and 10% do not have any sort of access at home, and that may be they simply don't have a computer at home or they don't have internet access at home. 63% of teens go online daily. Some more in-depth context on some of these numbers. Low-income teens are much more likely to say that they go online from school most often. They're also much more likely to go online from a library or places other than home. Probably not surprising to many of you who work with those kinds of populations. But also something to think about. This is your average teen, but there are certainly populations that are that look quite different than this. So what are teens doing online? I like to put this slide in because I always, when we're talking about internet safety, and that's our main theme for today, I always want to reiterate that there are so many things about the internet that aren't particularly scary, that are good, that are positive. That they're going online to do research for school assignments, as Anastasia hinted at. 94% of them do this, and more than half do so on a typical day. This is what they do with the internet. They also, however, research entertainment topics. They're going online to get news. They're creating some kind of content online. So they're engaging with the internet. It's both a push and a pull technology for them. They're watching videos. They're going online and looking for college information. They're buying stuff, and they're looking for stuff about health and physical fitness. But what have I not mentioned in that previous list? Social networks, which I think is, for many teens, the place where they now spend their time on the internet, as I think Anastasia suggested as well. 58% of online teens now have a profile online. That's our latest number. Obviously, age is the major factor. If you break it out, it's the older teens who have those profiles. 77% of 15 to 17-year-olds have a profile online. 38% of the 12 to 14-year-olds do. Girls are the dominant social network users, so the boys are holding their own, but the girls are still the most enthusiastic users. Other demographics are not a factor. Race, income. If you have access to the internet and you are an older teen, you are most likely using a social networking website. But let's get to the meat of what we're going to talk about today, which is concerns in the online safety sphere. And the way I think about this when I talk about it is that there's a couple of spheres, and you can kind of slice them a couple of ways. The two main ways that I divide it up is inappropriate contact, somebody talking to you or interacting with you, and inappropriate content, which is looking at something that is not that in general we do not want kids to look at. Now, from the Pew Internet Project perspective, what we've talked about most in our work is the first, internet contact, strangers and bullies, which I think roughly breaks out to strangers, which is people that you don't know, who are contacting you online in a way that you perhaps don't like, and then bullies who are contacting you, people you generally do know, who are contacting you online in a way that you generally don't like. There's also, it's important to mention that there is, again, this wanted and unwanted dichotomy when it comes to online contact. There is contact from strangers that is actually wanted by teens, that teens actually seek, and that is a totally different thing than teens actually having contact that they don't want and that they don't seek. Similar with inappropriate content, I'm not going to talk a lot about inappropriate content, mainly because my research has stayed away from it because it is often very hard to determine what is inappropriate content. As with things like obscenity, it's sort of community standards. Those vary widely in this country and outside of this country. And so because it is a hard thing to pin down, we have not looked at it so closely. I will present some data from some other researchers just to give us a little bit of context there. So moving on into our research on contact by strangers. So we asked teens if you had ever been contacted online by a complete stranger, and that is somebody who has no connection at all to you or your friends. And 32% of online teens said yes, have received some kind of content like that. So then we looked at that 32% of teens, and we asked them if they were ever made scared or uncomfortable by that content, that contact. And 23% of that group said, yes, I was made uncomfortable by that contact, which translates overall into about 7% of online teens having some kind of uncomfortable online experience. It is important to remember, however, that our definition of stranger is very broad. It is somebody unknown to you. That could include a peer. It could include somebody who's you know who's actually pretending to be somebody different. It doesn't necessarily have to be an adult. It could be an adult who doesn't have negative intentions. So there's a lot of different ways to think about who this stranger might be. We also did an in-depth analysis and tried to figure out what were the factors that most likely predicted contact by somebody that you didn't know on the internet. And we found that the factors most likely, in order of strength, are posting a photo, generally on a profile, but having some sort of photo posted online, having a profile online, being female, and using the internet to flirt. We then drilled down even further and asked about what were the factors most likely to predict scary contact, and it was simply being female. We don't know whether females interpret contact as something that is more scary, whereas a boy might not interpret that as a different kind of contact, or whether they truly do get contact of perhaps a more unpleasant nature than boys do. But certainly those were the factors that, from our research, suggested the greater likelihood of this contact. And so I think it's also important to note that there really weren't any other factors that predicted this, at least in our work. There's no association between stranger contact and other content you have posted on your profile. It doesn't matter whether you have your first name and your last name. It doesn't matter whether you post your city. It doesn't matter whether you post your school. It doesn't matter what else you post other than a picture, or having a profile, being a girl, using the internet to flirt. Social network users are more likely to have been contacted by a stranger, which is not surprising when you think about the point of a social network is to meet other people. And generally teens do, there's this real tension that teens are trying to keep themselves safe by making their networks private, which they do, which is the message that we've been sending to them loud and clear, which they are getting. But there's also, they want to be able to be found by the people that they know. And so you have to place enough information about yourself so that somebody can determine that in fact it is you when they reach out to you to join your profile. Other interesting findings, having internet monitoring software on your home computer is correlated with a lower reported levels of contact by somebody unknown to you. Filters are not related, but having monitoring software is. So this is some data from my colleagues at the UNH Crimes Against Children Research Center. And this really plays into, I think, what's some of the scariest stuff that's out there. And there's this number right there that you can see at the top of the slide that everybody hears about. This 1 in 7 teens reported unwanted sexual solicitation online, which is 13% of teens. And what the UNH folks are saying and have been saying, and there's a handout, which I'd be happy to send anybody who's interested in seeing it, is they have been unpacking this data finding because it often gets misused in the media. That, in fact, these sexual solicitations, more than half of them come from peers. The teens generally do not view them as threatening. They dealt with these situations effectively and sort of cut off all contact. They were generally not bothered by these kinds of solicitations. These solicitations could range from anything like your chemistry, you know, the creepy guy in your chemistry class asking you what your bra size is, to things that really were truly unpleasant. The aggressive solicitations is what the UNH folks are really emphasizing now. That is 4% of teens say they have received an aggressive solicitation. That's 1 in 25. And this aggressive solicitation is, in fact, where the person who solicited you attempted to make offline contact or to convince you, to try to convince you to make offline contact. They are very infrequently successful at that. Only, I think, 0.2% actually did go and meet somebody that they met online. There's also the other side of this that the UNH folks have been talking about, which is that much of this contact is actually that actually occurs, that actually ends up happening offline, is wanted, it is sought. It is from kids who have psychosocial problems in their offline lives. They go online looking for friendship, looking for sympathy, and they find it. They go and look for it in sexually oriented places, and they know generally that they are talking to adults, and they know when they go to meet them what is potentially going to happen when they do. And this comes from the UNH Crimes Against Research National Juvenile Online Victimization Study, which interviews law enforcement officers who have worked on these cases and have interviewed these child victims. So there is also, again, this, I'm going to go quickly through this because I don't have a lot of time, but there's all, again, all these myths about who are internet predators, that they're pedophiles targeting young children, they lie about their age, they're tricking children and they're stalking them, and it's forcible and a violent crime, when in fact the reality is that most of the victims are teenagers, few offenders are lying, most of them are open about their intentions, and most of the meetings are voluntary and without violence. So just some more of Pew Internet data, talking about this general response to stranger contact, which is similar to some of the data I just presented. Most teens are ignoring and deleting these kinds of contacts. Sometimes they're responding to sort of find out more about the person, but for the most part, it's, you know, it's click, delete, goodbye. So let's move on to bullying. 32% of online teens have experienced one of the following forms of online harassment. And I think it's important to note the parallel, that there's actually a similar amount of teens who have experienced bullying as who have experienced some kind of stranger contact. 15% of teens report having private material forwarded without permission. 13% had received threatening messages. 13% said someone had spread a rumor about them online. And 6% had had someone post an embarrassing picture of them without permission. Girls in particular are the ones who are most likely to have these experiences. 38% of online girls have experienced it. Social network users are also more likely to experience this. Again, we're seeing these parallels between these kinds of online experiences that teens are having. Interestingly, we asked teens where they think bullying happens more. Do they think it happens more online than offline? And they resoundingly said it happens more offline. This actually plays into research that Michelle Ybarra has also done, which in fact does show that youth report being bullied at school more than anywhere else in their lives, including the internet. 31% say that they have been bullied at school versus 13% who say they've experienced bullying online. Internet harassment is relatively stable. It is not necessarily increasing, as I mentioned. Similar to, again, sexual solicitations, the majority of harassment comes from other minors. And again, similar with the sexual solicitations, youth who report being harassed online generally have a lot of other psychosocial problems like depression, like problems with their families, other kinds of issues in their lives. And so we've been talking about here that I just presented some research that suggests that it doesn't actually really matter what you post on the internet in terms of your personal safety, in terms of keeping you safe from strangers who would like to harm you. But we've been giving teens this message that, hello, don't put your personal information online, keep it safe, lock it down, don't do this, you're going to put yourself at risk. And I think what that message may need to start changing is that you may not be putting yourself necessarily at risk from being harmed by an individual, but you may be putting yourself reputationally at risk. As Anastasia also talked about, at a certain point, the teens are sharing a tremendous amount of information online. Sometimes it is within a closed network, sometimes it's not. As we see, some teens are, in general, taking some kind of steps in their lives to keep their information private. They're also posting fake information, again, as an attempt to protect themselves, but also, as you can see from the quote at the bottom, because it's fun to pretend to be somebody older. It's fun to pretend to sort of get away from some of the negatives that are associated with teens that are sort of imposed upon them by adults. So this is the exposure data I mentioned. When I say exposure, this is exposure to inappropriate content. 24% of parents of online teens say their child has been exposed to inappropriate language or sexual violent content online. That's some cable in the recent cable in the classroom common sense media data. 23% of parents say inappropriate media content is one of their primary concerns. And then some data which I hesitate to present because it's almost antediluvian in its age in terms of the internet because it's from 2001, but it is the only data that I know of, which suggests that 70% of 15 to 17-year-olds have accidentally stumbled onto pornographic sites. 23% say that happens very or somewhat often. And of teens who are looking online for health information, 46% were blocked from non-pornographic sites they were looking for health information on by filtering technology. So just some quick final thoughts so that we can get on to our other panelists. Again, only a very small number of teens report uncomfortable online contact. Most ably handle it, this contact by deleting it or ignoring it. There's very little association between this contact and what you have posted online. The tiny number of teens who are victimized most often have a host of other issues and seek out a lot of this, these kinds of experiences online. And that bullying is reported by the same number of teens as stranger contact, and yet it still happens more offline than online. And with that, I'm going to stop. Thanks very much. So I think the plan was to start with Ajini. She's going to talk about her experiences with technology and teens.
Hi, good morning. My name is Jeannie Biddle. I'm from Scott County Schools in Georgetown, Kentucky. We have approximately 8,000 students, 13 schools, and we are considered to be in a rural urban location. Coming from New York, I consider them to be rural, but they're considered to be urban. One of the things that you're all sitting here and you have heard much of this, our students are sophisticated users of technology. And often they are surpassing the proficiency of the teachers. They also understand that we have in place for their safety, and they are very aware of this, that we have filtering systems, that we have proxies. And we try to work with them in understanding internet safety and digital citizenship. Most importantly, though, is that there is a separation between engaging our teachers in developing those lessons that are tied to the content in which they're teaching. So there is a little breakdown there. And part of what I'm talking to you about today is what I'm experiencing within my own district across the state and with other people that I've spoken with. We know that our students ritually comply with our acceptable use policies and our proxies and our filtering. And that's really important that we understand ritual compliance, because they are doing this because it's a need. Yet we also know those students who I consider the rogue warrior, and it's almost like a battle cry of rules were meant to be broken, and those that experience any block as a challenge to their own technical expertise. And we find them using anonymous proxies. How many of you are familiar with anonymous proxies? And even the little flash drives where they can download onto the flash drive an anonymous proxy. Now, to me, that's a double-edged sword, because we are talking to them about acceptable use and digital citizenship and internet safety. Well, they have read about anonymous proxies. So they understand that it will block who they are, it will prevent downloading a personal identification, it will prevent people from violating their own computers. Yet in the district situation, we see that as a negative direction. And I have to say that I'm torn on that, because I understand that we need to log and see where they're visiting, yet they are actually good consumers of what's out there to move them in a direction that maybe at home, that's what they prefer to do. The other discussions that we've had about examples of bullying and issues with internet safety, we have students at the high school, a few examples of using their phone. You know, we know that FF, friends forever. Well, in some instances, FF means phone fight. And one of the situations is between girls at the high school. They will have issues and fight, text messaging each other. And then it turns out that when we actually pull the students together, they have never actually been face-to-face. They have never sat down. They have never discussed the issue. And all it takes is a two-minute or three-minute conversation to sit them down at a table and have that discussion. And often they end up leaving and resolving the issue. But more importantly, it goes back to age-old situation with boys. The whole purpose of this phone fight was because the girl in the math class flipped her hair in a certain way in front of the boyfriend. So those are some of the issues that we're still working with in regard to using technology and addressing what our students are seeing in the classrooms and what's important to them. We met with our middle school students, and I truly believe that it's important for me to stay in touch with our population, so I go out and I talk with our students. I've sat in parking lots at the high school and gone to the middle school. They have at the middle school, and we see the movement from MySpace in middle school, starting in fifth grade, where they're not supposed to have that MySpace account, and they move over to Facebook when they become ninth or tenth graders and stay there, flip back to MySpace, and then move to YouTube and back and forth, sharing that information. Middle school students, we posted a few of their profiles. We did a search, we looked, and we wrote them in, and we had a little assembly, and we posted what it was in front of all their peers and colleagues, and some of them were mortified. Well, it's me, you know, and some of them were proud. And then we also pulled their parents in. We said, we want you to come to our assembly. We want you to know up front what it is exactly that we're doing, but we want you to be aware. We're not here to frighten you. We do not want you to lock down the internet. We don't want to have any of the problems, but we want you to be aware of how to be good stewards of the internet. As parents and as grandparents, because many of our grandparents have no idea what their grandchildren are doing when they come to visit. The other thing is that there's a discrepancy. Well, let me back up. New Year's Eve, I had seven 17-year-olds in my house using the Xbox and playing Call of Duty and Halo 3. And you can tell my New Year's isn't a very fun time. But for them, it was. And what I found out was that they were talking to people across the globe, and they were having a blast. But what I heard wasn't pleasing to me. I actually, heard one of the friends saying inappropriate comments to someone else. And I pulled my son aside, and I said, "That's not right. Why is he talking that way? He doesn't know this person. It could be someone's grandfather. It could be someone else. Hey, Mom, that's just the way we are. It doesn't mean anything." And I said, "It's not right." So that was an opportunity for me to talk with them all, and I told them what I felt. And they looked at me, whether they listened and whether they heard were two different stories. But I do think that that was an opportunity for me to say that what I felt. And I think that's where our teachers need to come in and utilize some of the sites that we are blocking. And that's part of my passion as a director of technology. I have an IT staff. I focus more on instruction. And at times, we are at odds. They block because that is the easiest direction to go to. Across the state, we are required to have a proxy. Most of us, 174 school districts, have a filtering system. And what we find is that the blocking is preventing teachers from utilizing the sites that our students are screaming to use. And there are easy ways to do that, with the teacher entering an administrative logon, and for that brief time, 40 minutes or 60 minutes of the classroom period, she has access. But even better, she has the opportunity to say, "I'm taking you to YouTube, and I want to show you a video. You may encounter such and such here, or you may see this. I'm not condoning it. I don't accept it, but I want you to be aware of it when you go back to home and you visit the site." And those are the breaches. Those are the issues that we're trying to identify and bring people together, especially our teachers and supportive administrators. So that's pretty much what we're seeing, and I'm wrapping up.
Great. Thank you, Jeannie. And now we'll turn to Julie and to Jake.
I think I'm just using this, right?
I think so.
Is this on?
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here today. What I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be sharing with you some of the findings that we have from our Speak Up project. If you're not familiar with our Speak Up project, it is an online survey project that we make available to schools and districts around the country so that you can get information about what your students, what your teachers, your parents, and your school leaders are thinking about technology and education. From our survey that we did last fall, we had about 367,000 surveys that were submitted to us from schools all across the country. We had a key finding, which actually was not revolutionary for us. It was the same key finding we found for the previous 4 years. And that finding won't be a surprise to any of you here. And it basically was about this digital disconnect between students and adults, and how the students are telling us that, in fact, they do have to power down when they come to our schools. They're living a much different digital world. much living in a much different digital world than what we're providing to them in their schools. And that same digital disconnect is apparent when we talk to students, teachers, and parents, and school leaders about internet safety. So just a couple statistics to kind of back that up. While over 70% of parents and over 60% of teachers tell us that they are concerned about students' use of the internet, particularly around online predators, the unwanted contact that Amanda talked about, less than 20% of our students in middle school and high school say that's a concern of theirs. Again, about 70% of parents and 60% of teachers say that they are concerned about protecting private information online, about students sharing too much information online. Less than a quarter of our students in grades 6 through 12 say that's of any concern to them. And whereas over a third of parents and teachers have a real concern about cyberbullying, less than 12% of students say that's a worry for them. So should we just write this off and say students are just being naive about the internet? They don't really understand the dangers that are out there? I don't think so. I think the students from the ones that we've talked to, and we also do focus groups all across the country, they do understand the dangers. They feel very strongly, though, that the benefits of that internet use outweigh any of the risks or concerns. And the more meaningful conversation is really about, well, what are the concerns that students have about internet use? And I'll tell you right now, it's different than what you and I may be thinking about. We thought it was interesting that over 43% of the students in middle school and high school told us that the number one thing that bugs them about internet use is that their adults and parents are too concerned about the safety issues to see what the real value is. And it comes really right back to this whole issue of productivity versus just engagement. You know, for a long time, particularly from an education standpoint, and we see this in our teacher and parent surveys, our educators talk about the value of technology being around engagement. Students are more engaged in learning when there's technology involved. It's interesting, when we actually talk to students, they don't necessarily say the same things. They talk about productivity gains. They talk about being able to have access to information that they can't have in other places. They talk about the accuracy. They talk about being more efficient and effective. They talk about being more productive. And so to some extent, we need to be changing our conversation, because while we're on one plane talking about engagement, and as we're talking about engagement, we're seeing these internet safety issues that we've been talking about here this morning, the kids are on a different plane. And they're looking at it as a means to be an effective professional or worker in whatever their tasks are. So we do need to think anew about all this. The other thing that really underscores all of that, and Jeannie and I have talked about this before, is that for the 5 years that we've been doing this survey, when we ask the students, and this cuts across all grades, what is the number one obstacle that you face in terms of using technology at school? That number one issue has been the same for 5 years. It's the filters and firewalls. And this year, we had 45% of students tell us that, in fact, their schools were regularly blocking sites that they wanted to use for their learning. So it goes way beyond the conversation about kids saying, oh, I can't instant message from school, or I can't go to my Facebook page. It's really, again, about the productivity issues associated with that. And so my call is really for us to think anew about what we're discussing in terms of the value of technology, and really then be able to underscore that conversation. But we have a wonderful opportunity with us here today, because we have Jake Young here with us, who is a senior in September, at Klein Oak High School, which is over in Spring, Texas. It's part of the Klein Independent School District. Jake also happens to be a member of our Speak Up Student Advisory Council. That's a group of about 24 students all around the world that help us craft the questions for the Speak Up survey to make sure that we're asking it in the right way and they're asking the appropriate questions. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to take a couple minutes here to interview Jake and get sort of his perspective. I know he's been really sort of biting at the bullet here to jump in on this conversation way back from when we were sitting over there. So we'll give him an opportunity, and then as Amanda said, we'll open it up to some questions. So Jake and I are going to share this one. So I'm going to start off, Jake, and I'm just going to ask a really broad question. So what do you think about this whole conversation we're having this morning?
I think it's very important. It will go a long ways toward improving safety that there on internet use that there, because there's no doubt there are problems, but they can be easily fixed if things like this take place and the concerns are shared and problems are solved and solutions are found and all that.
Were there some things that were said this morning that you disagree with?
Not really. I believe that most of the data found was correct. Yes, predators are hard to... predators can be found, but yes, most of us know how to deal with them. I mean, if someone contacts me on a chat, it's not that hard to close out the chat and open up a new one and go on my way. But so I don't concern myself with that so much. It's very easy to protect myself. You'd have to find someone that's very computer literate to be able to track you through that, but that would, there's no point in doing that. They're not going to take the time to do it.
Do you think most kids are prepared to deal with this?
I believe a lot of kids are prepared to do this because, yeah, we are, I hate to say it in front of everyone, we are a lot better with computers than most people. I'm not saying anything about y'all either. I'm pretty sure y'all have computer experience, but we know how to conduct ourselves. I'm not saying there's kids out there that do stuff online that's inappropriate, because I know a few people that do that myself in my school. It's not completely safe out there, but so yeah, I believe that we oh crap, I lost myself.
Just in terms of kids being prepared.
Yeah, we are all prepared.
How about in terms of, you and I talked the other day, your own internet use, the types of things that you're doing, and maybe maybe you can share with the audience some of the things that your parents have set up around your internet use.
As for my use, I'm part of the group that you would refer to as the geeks. I do hang out on online games, I create avatars. I don't necessarily code them, but I do create them. I hang out on online games like World of Warcraft. And my parents don't really like that because they are among the parents that fear for online predators and inappropriate content. But I try to tell them that it's not as bad as it seems, that news is pretty much making that problem seem a lot more than it really is. But because online games, when you're playing an online game, you're really focused on the game itself and not really talking back and forth about your own personal life. You get immersed into the game life. And so at that point, you're not really concerned about what that person's doing with their time, how they live their life, or where even they live outside of the game itself. But my parents, they don't allow me to keep social networking sites because of predators. They don't allow me to chat because of predators. And they don't allow me to play the games because of predators. So they've pretty much blocked me out from doing social networking. And it's really hard because all of my friends have social networking sites. One, actually, I think I do have a few friends that have sites on pretty much all of them, like Facebook, Zanga, and MySpace. So I'm left out of things that even YouTube. I'm left out of things that they come to school and they talk about a lot. Most of the conversations my friends have face-to-face are about things they saw online, especially YouTube. Because they'll go and they'll joke about videos that they saw or things that they've done. So I'm left out of things that would normally keep me in the conversation face-to-face.
Okay. Do you have any final... This is a group of educators, teachers, principals, district technology coordinators. Do you have any advice for them in terms of from the student perspective?
Lighten the filters on school computers. I can't do anything on my school computer without it being blocked. And even teachers at my school are calling for less on the filters because it's gotten to a point where it's just ridiculous. You can't do anything online without having to have an administrator go in and unblock it for you, and that usually takes 2 to 3 weeks. And as fast as schools have to move now with their lesson plans and everything, by the time they get it unblocked, you've already moved on to a new lesson. So, and at my school, we don't have a student email, or we might, but we don't use it all that much, and that's really hard for students to go home and say there's like a group project that they all have in the same class, well, it's very hard for us to collaborate on that project. So that's another plus for the social networking sites, because that's what we use those for a lot. But it would be nice if we could have a student email or some kind of student site at schools that would allow us to network even in school itself.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jake. We do have more information on what we heard from students. Thank you, Jake. On our website if you want to check into some more of our speak-up data. Back to Amanda.
Right.
Thanks, and that ends the speaking portion of this program, and so it's now your turn to ask questions, and I hope that if you have questions, you'll hop up to the mics and get in line, so that you'll see the microphones so that everybody can hear your question. I was going to start off, but we have some people starting, so we'll start here on the left, and then we'll bounce to the right.
Yes, my question is for Jake. I am interested, people have touched a little bit sort of on the security side, and as a member of sort of the younger generation, I would estimate that you might be a little more savvy about that than some of us. And, you know, the schools are relying a little bit on the filtering software, and some of them see that as a solution to making sure that some of the inappropriate content doesn't come through, and seeing that as a security fix as well. And I was curious to know, you know, where you picked up on, and if you have, on security fixes and things like that, and how to protect yourself from things like identity theft, and, you know, phishing emails like the Nigerian bank fraud and things like that. So just a few examples, et cetera. And if we had anything to teach you, or if you had mostly self-taught.
Well, I take classes on IT, I'm taking the Cisco IT Essentials for like computer maintenance and stuff, and they do teach you a lot on protecting yourself from viruses, worms, Trojans, identity theft. Mostly, I'm a tech nerd, so I go and buy magazines, like PC Magazine, and they have a lot of advice in there. And even, I even talk to some of my friends, and they show me devices, software, things that I can use to protect myself from identity theft and such problems as that.
Yeah. So. Just mostly from your peers?
Mostly from my peers.
Yeah. And you think you're pretty savvy generation, obviously.
Yeah.
Great.
They are.
Thank you very much.
Yes, over here.
Yes. At my school, we had I was told there was a visitor from the Republic of China, and it was a dissident, someone who was pretty reluctant at the government's way of controlling the people. So he showed the students at my school, I was told this, I'm not sure, a way to circumvent the filtering system. Because they wanted to get information outside of China and what the real world is doing. It may not be that way now. But my question is to the panel, anyone in the audience, because I talked to the vendor about this particular website. It's a proxy website. And I was told I need to get the IP address, but it's an HTTPS website, so it's not really broadcasting the IP address. It's hidden. It's hidden. So my question is, have anyone have this issue, and how do you deal with it?
That's not my question.
I can tell you in general, the students that we talk to through the Speak Up survey, and I don't want to scare anyone here in the audience, but they tell us the filters are basically for the unmotivated. That any student that really wants to be able to get around a filter or a firewall is going to find their way around it anyway. That's what the kids tell us. I don't know, Jake, do you have anything?
The filtering that we use on the computers at our school, which is BESS and Lightspeed now, but they have actually, I don't know exactly how they do it, but they've found a way to block the sites. And I think what you have to do is trace the website back to its host server.
Right.
And that can be done. I think you go into the command prompt and just run tracer.
I've tried that, yes.
Tried that and it didn't work.
And the thing about it, it sends the IP address that it sends back goes back to the .com or the unsecured address. Mm-hmm. But they're using a secured address, HTTPS, and it, when you do a trace on it, it sends back the IP address of the HTTP.
Why don't we have someone here? I'm sorry to interrupt because we have a lot of questions. Why don't we afterwards maybe somebody here with that
here had a question.
Well, can I just give you a little brief history of a disciplinary situation that we dealt with? And keep in mind, this was a fifth grader, Beth? Sixth grader? Fifth or sixth grader. And he used proxies to bypass our filters. But what we discovered is that every night he hits return and goes to some site that downloads different websites, hundreds of them daily, that he can use to type in to bypass our filters. So when we catch one, we've only caught a needle in a haystack of needles. So finding one, you may spend hours and hours, but there are so many, they'll just use another one. And that's what he told us he did. So good luck.
Okay. Good luck.
Next question, lady in the pink.
Yes, that has happened in our school district too, and the students tell me all the time, oh, we can get around that, you know, and then I report it, and then they go on and find another one to get around. But my question is to Jake. And Jake, I believe I heard you say that your parents don't allow you to have social networking space. Is that correct? Did you say that? Or?
Yes, ma'am.
And then in the same breath, you want them to lighten up the filters in the schools, which I tend to agree with on some things. But then what do you do if you get on a social network or you have, at school and your parents find out what are your parents going to do? What are they going to say?
Honestly, I wouldn't know. I think they would say maybe it's for the best since you're doing it at school, as long as you're just using it for school activities and nothing else.
Okay. And I do agree with you on student email. I do believe that the school district should have student email because most students have email anyway. And they do get on it at school. They find a way around it. And the student email, such as Gaggle, I'm not with Gaggle, but that's one that we use. And it has a great filtering system, and you know you can send work, you can do all kinds of blogging and types of things that have to do with the schoolwork. Send homework to your teachers and so forth, and do cooperative lessons and things like that. So I do agree with you on the student email.
Thank you. Yeah, in the blue.
One of the things that you said stood out to me is that the difference between educators seeing technology as helping with engagement, whereas students see it more as helping with productivity. My question is having to do with acceptable use policies that all these students have to sign. So I'd like to address Gene. Gene, do you guys have an acceptable use policy that you think is pretty up to date? Because apparently, a lot of acceptable policies that I've read are all old school, where they're focused more on engaging students and also blocking and filtering a lot of things. It's not more up to date, I guess, with the latest research. So,
okay. The acceptable use policy across the entire state of Kentucky, every student has an email account, 4th through 12th grade. Students from K through 3 use an email account that's under the teacher's name. What we found is that we're paying for licensing for those email accounts, but students choose to use Gmail or other accounts because they upload large files or images, and they find that email is limited because of the size. Getting to your question about the acceptable use policy, we work collaboratively with the Kentucky School Board Association to develop an acceptable use policy that demonstrates to all teachers, staff, students, or anyone who's a volunteer, exactly their expectations for network use, if they come on the network, whether they bring their own computer or it's a school computer, what the consequences are if they use it inappropriately. The one issue that we have is that it has no teeth. So what we can do is if a student does something inappropriately, we have to consider, do we take away internet access? Would you take a book away from a student if they wrote in it? So we've had those conversations back and forth. So we find an alternative way to address the issue, and then those issues that go back to violation of the acceptable use policy, proxy, harmless proxies, is that that becomes a behavior issue. How do we deal with behaviors? That's a behavior consequence, a policy procedure.
So there really is no acceptable use policy that's been developed that would reflect latest research. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's not necessarily research. It's what we're seeing, the trends for phones, for bringing your own computers from home.
Trends, yeah.
Yes, we address those. They would be used in the same way for bringing your phone from home. When you bring a computer from home and you're accessing the network, you need to abide by those rules.
So. I'm just looking for an example, an acceptable use policy that I can start with.
I'd be glad to share it. It's on our website.
Yeah.
See you later. Okay. So the next question, we really only have time for one last question. So
okay, a couple quick comments, and then this question's for
just actually, if we can just focus on the question so we can ask more questions.
I wanted to say I'm from the state of Virginia, and we have an acceptable use policy. The internet safety component is built into the acceptable use policy. As a result of that, we are doing numerous things in our division. We have websites. We have relationships with the Sheriff's Department. With our own personnel in terms of teaching the internet safety component. I'm a 30-year veteran in the field of education, yet I continue to be concerned about the fact that we're doing so many of these things. We even had our task force, Operation Blue Ridge Thunder, come in and give graphic demonstrations of the things that go on. But yet our children continue to send naked pictures across the internet. They continue to use their cell phones, something we don't have control of outside of determining that they can't bring them to school at all to do things that actually are illegal. Their classmates have been suspended, have been expelled, yet we still can't tend to get through to them in the manner in which, I would like to. What other advice, other than things that you all have thus said, can we do to ensure that our students learn that these things have some long-range effects on their lives?
Yeah, good.
I believe the panel addressed some of that. Are students Googling to see what comes up under their name? Part of the responsibility lies with the parents and helping us to develop that awareness through parent-teacher associations, utilizing your family resource centers, your law enforcement, getting the word out at your chamber of commerce. Digital citizenship and internet safety is not just an educational situation. It is your entire community. We're all a learning organization. So,
I would also say, there's nothing sort of more powerful than peer education. Teens listen to other teens. So if you could sort of build up, the teens in your school who are showing interest in some of these issues, or maybe even the hackers who are, getting around the proxies, and get them to sort of be the leaders to talk about some of these issues with their peers, I think that that's another really powerful teaching tool that you have right at your disposal. And it sounds a lot different than an adult or a parent or a cop or somebody else trying to tell teens to do that.
And I also would encourage you to stay for the next portion, in which we will talk more about some of these issues and talk more about some solutions and tools. So thanks very much for this panel. And we are out of time. We need to switch to the next panel. And so thank you very much.